It is, I think, more than just a little bit ironic that the word church causes so much confusion. The way that word is used in the New Testament causes so much confusion and has led to so much error in the religious world. We spend a considerable amount of time, and we do that because we have no choice, unteaching or correcting error that people have about church and what that word means. And we understand and recognize that the word means, it doesn't, well, the word doesn't mean, but it signifies, it represents people. And that it always represents people, regardless of how it's being used. And we've devoted entire lessons to distinguishing between the two primary ways that the word church is used in the New Testament. The universal church, that phrase doesn't appear anywhere in the Bible, but the concept is sound. That sometimes when the word church is used, as a matter of fact, my judgment is that this is true most of the time that the word church appears in the New Testament. It's talking about it in this broad sense of a body that contains people. And those people are all saved people. Not just living on the face of the earth at the present time saved people, but all saved people of all times. That body is referred to over and over again in the New Testament as the church. That has to be the way Jesus meant us to understand that word when he said, for example, when Peter confessed that Jesus was the Christ in Matthew chapter 16, that on this rock, based upon that confession, in other words, I will build my church, and that the gates of Hades would not prevail against it. That it's being used in that sense of this body that contains all saved people. In Acts chapter 2, when the Lord was adding those who were being converted, who were touched by the preaching of the gospel and being converted, when he were adding them to that body, the King James and the New King James translation says added to the church, but most of the older Greek manuscripts don't contain the word church there, but the idea is sound, the idea is right. To what was he adding them? He was adding them to this body of saved people. That's the most prominent way that the word is used in the New Testament. I think the second probably most prominent way that the word is used involves some kind of local and geographic sense. A local church, a local body of people, theoretically at least, this body of people consists of people who have already been added to the church, the body of saved people by God. They live in the same geographical location, and so God wanted them to come together, to constitute them together into an assembly that we refer to as the local church. That expression doesn't appear in the New Testament either, but Paul addresses letters to local churches, the church at Corinth, the churches of Galatia. For example, the church at Philippi. Again, Christians, people who are already part of this body of saved people, to whom God has added them, and now they come together, they share that relationship, and they come together and they constitute this local body. Now, when we think about the local church, and let's go back to the reading that we did just a few moments ago in 1 Corinthians chapter 11. When we come to the local body, one of the things that appears clear to me, at least, as you read through the New Testament, is that when it comes to the local body, God intended for that local body to come together from time to time. He intended for it to assemble. There is no way that the universal church can assemble short of the end of the world. The local church will assemble. It will be a great assembly, but the assembly will take place around the throne of God. That's the only time when all saved people will be together in one place. And so when we talk about assembling, when Paul talks about assembling, and he does frequently in this text, he's got to be talking about the local church. Verse 18, for example, for in the first place, when you come together as the church. Verse 20, therefore when you meet together. Verse 33, so then my brethren, when you come together. And the same thing in verse 34, if anyone is hungry, let him eat at home, so that you will not come together for judgment. And so God intended for local bodies to assemble, for local bodies to come together. You see the same thing in 1 Corinthians chapter 16. in the instructions that Paul gives about the collection for the saints, he says in verse 2, on the first day of the week, each one of you is to put aside and save as he may prosper, so that no collections may be made when I come. The implication is that at a time when they would be assembled together, they were to take up and put together this collection that would be used for needy saints. So I want us to focus for a few minutes in the lesson this evening on that aspect of church. And I want to talk about, I know that this will raise eyebrows as soon as you see this, but I want to talk about the church building. Maybe that's not the best thing to call it. I know that we've devoted considerable time and energy and attention to telling people that the church is not the building. And so I hope you'll allow me at least to use that expression accommodatively in the lesson tonight. That you know that I know the difference. That I don't believe that the church is the building. But I think it's proper to talk about the church building in the sense in which we're going to discuss it tonight. And that involves the assembling or the coming together of the church. There's a lot of confusion in the religious world about that particular aspect of local church work and what the local church does. So I want us to think about some things that are associated with the church building. I want to ask a question at the very beginning, and it's an important question. It's a question that I think I know the answer to. You know, I've seen enough Matlocks and Law and Order episodes to know that a good attorney never asks a question to which they don't already know the answer. And I've learned down through the years that that's not bad advice for a preacher either, to not ask a question that you don't know the answer to. But it is a question that gets asked a lot. It's a question about which books have been written. It's a question about which books have been written by some of our brethren. Is there authority for a church to have a building? And the obvious answer to that question from this perspective, I think, would be yes. We are in a building. We're in the building in which we customarily meet. It wouldn't be very consistent of me to answer that question no. Or at least it would be suicide on my part, I suspect, to answer that question no. But I want you to understand that I'm not answering it in any kind of a self-serving way. Is there authority for a church to have a building? Yes. I put the answer in all capital letters. I put an exclamation mark behind it because I wanted to emphasize and stress that it is an emphatic answer. Very often, when the question is asked, do we have authority to have a church building? The question is not being asked by someone who's genuinely and sincerely looking for information. In my experience, with some exceptions, please understand, but in my experience, the vast majority of times, and a number of times I've been asked this question, the vast majority of times that I've been asked that question, the question was being asked by someone who believed they knew the answer. And in their mind, the answer was no. There is no authority to have a church building. I believe that's wrong. I believe that there is authority to have a church building. And it falls into the category or under the realm of generic authority. There are two different kinds, at least two different kinds of authority, not just in religious matters. But there are these same two kinds of authority exist in the scientific world, in the academic world, and whatever circumstances and situations we find ourselves in. What do we mean by generic authority? Well, what we mean by that is this. God requires an assembly. The local church must come together. And I can't imagine that there would be anyone who would examine passages like we've just looked at in 1 Corinthians chapter 11 and say that that's not so. It's just so clear. When you come together as a church, when you are assembled, Hebrews chapter 10 and verse 25, do not forsake the assembling of yourselves together. That can't be instruction to the local, to the universal church, because again, the universal church cannot. I mean, it's a physical impossibility. It's a spiritual impossibility at the present time. for the universal church to assemble because we occupy two different spheres of reality. The vast majority of people who are in the universal church are somewhere beyond this earth. Only a small number of us are still living on the face of the earth, but one of these days we will assemble together around the throne of God when God sends Jesus back to bring the world to an end, when He separates the sheep from the goats, then all of the universal church will be assembled together around the throne of God. The book of Revelation makes that clear. So anytime there is teaching or instruction about a church coming together or assembling, it has to of necessity be talking about the local church. The local church is required by God to assemble. And so we necessarily infer that an assembly requires a place. Now, you know, I've asked a lot of different people down through the years whether or not they think that's a valid conclusion to draw. God demands that we assemble. He requires that we assemble. Can we necessarily infer that that requires a place? And I've never had anybody say no. As a matter of fact, if you would answer no to that question, I'd like to know how you would reconcile those two things. If God requires us to assemble, how does that not necessitate that there be a place of assembling? That there's got to be some place where we come together. That's what we mean by generic authority. The authority to have a place to assemble is inherent in the command to assemble. And that's a necessary conclusion. That if we are commanded to assemble, there must be a place. That's not really usually the problem, though, is it? In the minds of people who ask the question, is there authority for a church to have a building? And again, many times they assume that they know the answer to that question. They assume that they're asking you a question that's going to put you in a predicament, that you can't prove that there is biblical authority to have a church building. And I've actually seen, you know, really surprised and even shocked looks on people's faces sometimes in the past when they've asked me that question, Gary, is there authority, is there a Bible authority to have a church building? And they're expecting me to say, well, no, but I don't say that. I say, absolutely, yes, certainly there is. I wouldn't want to be doing something for which we did not have Bible authority. That catches people off guard. There is authority to have a building. Authority for the place is inherent in the command to assemble. That's a logical, reasonable conclusion to draw. The only way that conclusion, incidentally, can be refuted or overthrown is if either one of the premises can be proven to be faulty or flawed in some way. And I don't think either one of them can. We are commanded, we are instructed, we are taught in the New Testament as local churches to assemble. That's number one. Number two, that necessarily implies that we've got to find some place to do that. We've got to have a physical location to bring everybody together. The conclusion that we draw then is that there is authority, generic authority, in the command, inherent in the command to assemble for having a place. Really, the real question is this. And more often than not, when people ask that first question, is there authority for a church to have a building? Really what they're asking is the second question. And that is there authority for the church, or is there authority for the church to have a church building in a specific place, to own property, in other words? The only way we can answer a question like that is by going to the New Testament. Where did local churches meet in the New Testament? Acts chapter 2 and verse 46. Where did the church meet? They met in the temple. On a daily basis, they were coming together in the temple. That doesn't mean in the holy place or in the most holy place. It doesn't even mean in the court immediately surrounding the temple. But in the temple that Herod had constructed, there were large open areas. There were large colonnaded porches where you could get large groups of people out of the sun or out of the weather, and where numbers of different groups could be meeting at one time. It was a large space. And we know that the church met there. I don't know how long they met there, but they met in the temple area in Acts chapter 2 and verse 46. We find in passages like Colossians 4 and verse 15 and Romans chapter 16 and verse 5 that a number of years later, after Acts chapter 2, after the establishment of the church, We find Christians meeting in private homes, churches meeting in private homes, in other words. The local churches coming together to worship, to do the things that God would have them to do, and they're doing that in private homes. There's an example of that in Colossians chapter 4 and verse 15, where Paul says, "Greet the brethren who are in Laodicea, and also Nympha, and the church that is in her house." In other words, the church that is meeting in her house. It's interesting that Paul had never been to Colossae, but he knows about the church there, and he knows that there is a church meeting in this woman's house. The same thing's true about the church in Rome. Paul had never been there either, but he knows something about this church, and he knows that there is a church that's meeting in a private home in Rome. In Romans chapter 16 and verse 5, "Greet the church that is in their house," talking about Prisca and Aquila. "Greet the church that is in their house." And then he passes along other greetings as well. And so the church in Colossae, or at least a church in Colossae, was meeting in someone's home. The church in Rome, or a church in Rome at least, was meeting in someone's home. We have biblical examples of that. But we have biblical examples of the church meeting, a biblical example of the church meeting in the temple. Not only that, but there's an example of a church that was meeting in a school. In Acts chapter 19 and verse 9, it says that when some were becoming hardened and disobedient, speaking evil of the way before the people, he withdrew from them and took away the disciples, reasoning daily in the school of Tyrannus. I love that name. I love that name. The school of Tyrannus. You know, I suspect that every little child in the auditorium knows what a T-Rex is. Tyrannosaurus Rex. You understand that that's what this guy's name is. And he's running a school. My guess is that the name came after. It's difficult to imagine a mother looking at an innocent little baby, newborn baby, and saying, "I think I'll call him Tyrant. I think I'll give him that name." School of Tyrannus, but it's a school. So it's a private building, but it's not a home. It's not a private home. It's a place where education is conducted, and that teaching went on for some period of time. Paul says in the city of Ephesus, they were meeting in Tyrannus's school for a period of time while they were in Ephesus. In Acts chapter 20. Maybe in the same opening or on the next page in your New Testament, Paul goes to Troas. And in verse 7, on the first day of the week, when we were gathered together to break bread, so here we have an assembly of the local church. And it says in verse 9 that there was a young man named Eutychus sitting on the windowsill, sinking into a deep sleep. And as Paul kept on talking, he was overcome by silence and fell down from the third floor and was picked up dead. Whatever the structure was in which the church at Troas was meeting, it had a third floor. Some of you may have homes that have three stories in them. But that's not typical, is it? I mean, even upper middle class, three-story private dwelling places are the exception. They're not the rule. Now, some people would say, well, you know, I've got a basement, and then I've got two stories above. I would rather fall out of the second story of that kind of a three-story building than to fall out of a legitimate third-story building. Almost all commentators are in agreement. Nobody knows what this building was, but it almost certainly was not a private home. To have been a building that had three floors in it. In a small town like Troas, especially, Troas was not a metropolis like the city of Ephesus was. It was basically just a little jumping-off place to either get on a ship and go across the Adriatic Sea to Greece, or to come from Philippi, from the port down from Philippi, and come back across to Asia. Not much to Troas. You got a building there with three floors. Whatever it was, that's where the church was meeting. That's where the church was assembled together. Now, you put all of that together, and you draw another conclusion. Is when we think about the place, is one particular place bound when we think about the Bible authority? Must we worship in this kind of place? Now, that's a legitimate point, and it's a legitimate question for several reasons. Again, I've had this question, is there authority for a church to have a building, asked me a number of different times, more often than not by people I don't consider to be Christians, but occasionally by some who profess to be Christians. And what you'll hear, and there's a paradox in this argument. Because most of the time, people who make this kind of argument, most of the time, if you're talking about other things, what these people are going to say is, we don't have any right to bind our opinions. We don't have any right to, you don't have any right to insist that it has to be done this way. You know, they want to profess that I've got freedom. But then you start discussing the building, and all of a sudden it flips around, and they're saying, you've got to meet in a private home. You know, churches in the new, I've had people tell me, I have two books, as a matter of fact, one of them in my office here and one of them is on my desk in my study at the house. I have two books in which the authors of the books contend that it's a known fact that every church met in a private home in the first century in the New Testament. I don't see that, do you? For a while, the church at Jerusalem didn't meet in a private home. They met in an open public area. They met in the courts of the temple. That was still going on. They're meeting in the temple, by the way, as you move on into Acts chapter 3. The church at Ephesus didn't meet in a private home. They met in a school. Specifically told that they met in the school of Tyrannus. We don't know what the building was in Acts chapter 20, but it's not likely that it was a private home because of how large it was, because it had three floors. It might have been a private home. And I wouldn't insist that, and I would never insist that I know for certain that it wasn't a private home, but what I would say is this. Prove to me that it was a private home. You prove to me that they were meeting in a private dwelling place. No particular place is bound when it comes to the authority of the New Testament. And if that's the case, then any desirable place, any suitable place will do. We meet the command, we meet the generic command to assemble together by providing a place. Now, it's obvious. If you know anything about the history of local churches in this country, at least for the last, I would say, 150 years, I think really even longer than that, maybe going back 200 years, that the rule among our brethren, and with not many exceptions, generally speaking, the rule is that even if they don't start out meeting in a building that is property that they've purchased and built a structure similar to or something similar to the structure in which we're meeting tonight, that's where they end up. This church, if I understand correctly the history of the East Side Church, this church did not start out meeting in this particular building. They met somewhere else. This property was purchased. And then this building, sometime in the 1960s, this part of the building at least, was built. And brethren have been meeting in this building from that time until the present time. That's the rule, pretty much. So most brethren, and especially if local churches have existed for any time at all, most brethren meet in church buildings. So the second question is it desirable to have a place like a church building today? And the answer to that question, I think, is also an emphatic yes. That it is desirable to have a place. And one of the reasons why I think that's so is because church buildings almost always contain more than just a meeting place or more than just a meeting hall. This church building is typical of most church buildings among our brethren with which I'm familiar. It contains classrooms. Do we have authority to have classrooms in a place like this? Yes, we do. Generic in the command that's given to local churches to teach. The classrooms become an expediency then. They expedite the opportunities that we have to teach all different age groups of people. What about restrooms? You know, could we do without the restrooms? Not from where I'm standing, we couldn't. I mean, I'm the one that has to look at the sometimes almost steady parade of people getting up and leaving and coming back. And I'm just assuming that you're taking advantage of the bathroom facilities, not that you've had all of me that you can take and you just had to get out for a while. I mean, I'm assuming the other. And, you know, I've been places where I preached before where there was an epidemic of bladder disease, bladder problems, that, you know, people who couldn't go more than 15 minutes, people who couldn't wait till the end of the invitation song to get to the bathroom, before the end of the services, that, and it's really sad that people's bladders have deteriorated and degenerated to such a point. Do you feel the sarcasm just dripping on my notes here on the page? We have restrooms. And that expedites our ability to meet and do the things that that we need to do. As a matter of fact, it more than does that. Any public gathering of people, in almost any situation or any circumstance, local zoning laws and local ordinances will require, will insist that restroom facilities be provided. I'll let you in on, it's not a secret, I'll let you in though on just a little bit of what's going on. The elders are talking about expanding the auditorium and getting more seats, moving pews further apart and still coming up with more seats. It's magic, but you know, we're trying to do it. But we know that if we get started on construction work, expanding the auditorium, the city of Bowling Green is going to come in and they're going to say, you've got to upgrade your bathroom facilities. You don't have enough facility. In other words, that probably, depending on what kind of construction that is decided to be done, the city's going to come in and say, we won't let you do it unless you show us that you're going to provide restroom facilities that meet the Bowling Green and the Warren County code. So we'll have to do that. We'll have to take care of that. In other words, the zoning laws don't give us any choice about providing things like bathrooms. A cry room is nice. You know, to have a place where you can take a baby that's fussing, and where you can change a diaper, where you can rock a baby to sleep maybe. I mean, just, you know, those kinds of things. But you don't miss what's going on. In the auditorium, you have audio available, you have video available, that you can still feel like you're a part of the worship, so the cry room or the nursery. Most buildings provide those kinds of facilities. As a matter of fact, my guess is that the vast majority of people who are ever under any circumstances going to visit and want to be a part of a group, they're going to insist that some of these kinds of things be in place, or they're not going to stick around very long. They're not going to stay very long. They're not going to be a part, even if it's a public place in which we're meeting. I mean, even if it's a place that we've rented, or if it's a place that we get and it just isn't even cost us anything, it's going to have facilities or arrangements made for facilities like this in some form or another. Owning the building facilitates the use of different kinds of things like this. Most building codes mandate some of these extra facilities. Well, the third question then is, is there authority to have a church building? Yes, there is authority to have a church building. Is it desirable to have a church building, to have a place where we meet, where people can, they'll know we're there. They can count on us being there. Yes. Now remember, what kind of place? That's a question of judgment. It would be wrong for me to say you must, if you're a local church, you must buy property. You must build a building. It must have an auditorium like this. And if it doesn't, you're not a faithful church of Christ. It would be wrong for me to bind that on someone. But let me tell you, brethren, it would be just as wrong. It is just as wrong for people to try to say you have no right to own that property. You have no right to own that building. The place is left up to the circumstances. I've preached in storefronts. I've preached in private homes. I've preached outside. I've preached in a building that served other purposes. I'll have more to say about that in just a few moments. But served other purposes other than just the meeting place of the local church in a given community. But does that mean that we're saying that there's something unique or special about the building? Is the building a holy place? The answer to that question is no. It's not. Now, I know most people in the religious world would say that it is. A lot of people have the idea that the church is the building. And the building then becomes in their mind a special place. As a matter of fact, a room like this room in which we're meeting is called in many places in the religious world the sanctuary. Sanctified. Holy. In other words, that the place becomes holy because of the function that is carried on there or because of the purpose for which it is used. That's not the case. It was the case at one time. In the Old Testament, the tabernacle and later on the temple was a holy place. And the reason that it was a holy place is because God's presence was there. Look at Exodus chapter 40, for example. At the end of the book of Exodus, as the tabernacle is being erected, it's being set up. And in Exodus chapter 40 and verse 34, it says, "Then the cloud covered the tent of the meeting, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle." God was there. The presence of God was there. Not just in a symbolic sense, but in a very real sense. Years later, in 2 Chronicles chapter 7 and verse 16, when the temple that was built by Solomon has been constructed and is being dedicated by Solomon. In 2 Chronicles chapter 7 and verse 16, God says, "For now I have chosen and consecrated this house, that my name may be there forever, and my eye and my heart will be there perpetually." And so God's presence was there. We're studying the book of Ezekiel in the auditorium or in the classroom where I'm teaching back in the back, and one of the things we saw in Ezekiel chapter 8 is that God took Ezekiel, I think in a vision probably, but God took Ezekiel to Jerusalem. And he let Ezekiel see an incredibly profound thing. Ezekiel watched while the glory of the Lord left the holy place. And then it left the most holy place. And then it went to the eastern gate of the city, and then it left the city of Jerusalem. Ezekiel saw that. God leaving Jerusalem. The glory of God leaving Jerusalem. The tabernacle and the temple were places that were holy because they represented the presence of God. But that's not true any longer. Paul was preaching in Athens in Acts chapter 17 in a city where he was surrounded by temples, where idols were worshipped. Those places were holy places in the minds of people. And Paul tells them about God, the one true God, that he does not dwell in temples made with hands. The reason for that is what we've already noticed or what we've already seen. He dwells in his church now. Look at Ephesians chapter 2 and verse 22. Ephesians chapter, actually I think we'll start with verse 19 in Ephesians chapter 2 and read down through verse 22. Where the Apostle Paul says, "So then you are no longer strangers and aliens, but you are fellow citizens with the saints, and you are of God's household, having been built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Christ Jesus himself being the chief cornerstone, in whom the whole building, being fitted together, is growing into a holy temple in the Lord, in whom you also are being built together into a dwelling of God in the Spirit." You know, where does God dwell now? Well, he dwelt in the tabernacle when it was standing. When it was taken down and the temple was built by Solomon, he dwelt there. But then he let the Babylonians destroy it and he removed himself from there. Now, Paul says, he dwells in the church. He dwells in us. And that's why Paul says in Acts chapter 17 that he doesn't dwell in temples made with hands. In other words, this place is not special, it's not sanctified, it's not holy in the same way that the tabernacle and the temple were. It's just a place. Now, I understand and recognize that that probably raised some eyebrows, too. Because some people have in their minds the idea that this place becomes unique and special. And so we need to deal with one more question. One more question. And that is, for what can a church building be used? Two extremes to avoid. One extreme is, well, Gary, you just said that the building's not holy. And I did say that, and I believe that the scriptures support that. Then, doesn't that mean that we could use it for anything that we want to use it for? And the answer is no, we can't. The other extreme would be, well, I understand and recognize that the building's not holy, but it was purchased with the Lord's money. In that sense, it belongs to God. And so there's almost nothing for which the building can be used. As a matter of fact, there is absolutely nothing for which the building can be used if we cannot find specific authority in the New Testament for using the building that way, for using the property in that way. Now, I think those are extreme positions. Extreme to the left, we can use it for anything. Extreme to the right, we can't use it for anything unless we can pinpoint specific Bible authority for the use of the church building. Well, let me suggest to you that obviously the answer to a question like that, for what can a building be used, has to be determined. The answer to the question must be based on Bible authority. That's how we determine that we have the right to have a place to meet, a building in which to meet, a structure in which to meet, generic authority established from the Bible. And so what does the Bible have to say about the use of a facility or the use of a structure like this? Well, let me suggest to you that there are some questions that can help us to answer that question. Is what we are doing a required religious collective activity? In other words, are we doing in this, whether we own it or rent it, or somebody just loans it to us, or whether we're just meeting out under the trees somewhere, are we doing the things that God would have us to do as local churches? That's a legitimate question to ask. By the same token, is there an example of a church in the New Testament using a meeting place in exactly this same way? It's dangerous when we start tampering with God's Word. Would the building be used in this way be adding to God's Word? Would the proposed use of the building be taking away from God's Word? In other words, what I'm suggesting is we can go to the Bible. And we can pinpoint specific things for which a structure like this, again, doesn't matter how we got it. And it doesn't matter how we're maintaining it. We have the right to have it. Whether we rent it, whether we own it, or whether it's loaned to us or somebody just gives it to us, all of those are just expedients. How do we use it? And we're going to use it by going to the Scriptures, obviously. And are the things that we're doing the things that God would have us to do within the structure of the church building? But I want to expand on that a little bit. Because I don't think it stops there. I'd be more comfortable if it ended there. Let's just say that we've got this place and it was used by the Lord's money, and so we're not going to do anything in this structure for which we cannot find some specific authority in the New Testament. Let me suggest to you that we don't do that, practically speaking. We don't do that, practically speaking. And the reason we don't is because we understand and recognize the realm of expediency. We, the Eastside Church of Christ, under the oversight of the elders of the Eastside Church of Christ, we use this building for some things that we cannot put our finger on in the Scriptures and say, there it is, in black and white, there it is, there's the use for it. Well, I love when I get people's attention like this. You know, Pierre, you are listening more closely now than some have listened for a long time. What in the world is he talking about? We don't do anything here for which we cannot find specific authority. I believe that we do. We do some expedient things here. Now, there are some things we don't do. The building is not to be used as a place where the church, as the church, carries on social activities. 1 Corinthians chapter 11 makes that clear. What? Don't you have houses to eat and drink in? You know, if you want to have somebody over for dinner, you know, if you want to talk about the weather, if you want to talk about the ball game yesterday, Paul said, do that at home. You've got houses and private homes in which to do that. Incidentally, does that not, I wouldn't press this, but when Paul says, do you not have houses in which to eat and drink, does that not imply that the church in Corinth wasn't meeting in a private home? You've got homes. Go there and eat. Again, I wouldn't press that point, but it seems logical to me that the church at Corinth was not meeting in a private home. Again, it's beyond my comprehension how someone with any familiarity with the Bible at all could assert so forcefully and so positively all churches in the first few centuries met in private homes. That's not true outside the Bible, let alone what we know of from the Bible. But expediency, convenience, in other words, might dictate other uses under certain conditions. Let me give you some examples. Where you know, I suspect, I promise you I don't know, but I suspect that feeding of babies goes on back in that little room back there. Am I right about that? That babies are fed back there? Where would you go in the New Testament and say, here's the passage that authorizes a mother to feed a baby in this structure, in this facility? And what passage would you use? You know, again, what we're saying is, you know, are we going to take the position that we will not use this building for anything for which we cannot demonstrate clear, unequivocal, specific authority? Now, and again, I think a lot of people would say, amen, yes, that's exactly what we're going to do. But what I'm saying is we don't do that in practice. We allow the mothers to do that. I think rightly so. I have no problem with that being done. But it's just an expedient. It just so happens, in other words, that the times when we assemble sometimes correspond with the time when your child wants to eat. You know, we talked about that in a lesson a few weeks ago, didn't we? Aren't they selfish little things? Try saying to your six-month-old, listen, you know, we'll be finished in a few minutes. You wait till we get home. I wish some would say it to their 16-year-olds, but don't say it, you know, that it just becomes expedient. And so we allow that to happen. And we don't have any problem with that. I don't have any problem with that. Although it's just an expedient. It's not something for which you could say, here is the specific passage that authorizes something like that. What about this? Somebody's working at the building, like me. Yes, I work. You know, I run down to Subway and I get, because they've got a $5 foot long. Now, what that means is I can cut it in two and make two meals out of it. Most of the time, that's what it means. And I bring my sandwich back and I sit at my desk and I keep working on Ezekiel chapter 22 while I'm munching on my sandwich. Have I violated the sanctity of the order? I would say no. Now, I know some people would say yes. I would say no. I thought we taught in the churches of Christ that you're not supposed to eat in the church building. Well, you know, that's a different issue. That's talking about the collective action of the church. That's talking about, you know, the church didn't buy my Subway sandwich. I mean, and if one of you wants to buy me a Subway sandwich, that would be fine. But the church doesn't buy the Subway sandwiches and provide them for anybody. I wouldn't have a problem with that kind of thing happening. Maybe somebody's here working on the baptistry, or, you know, maybe if we decide to expand the auditorium, there's going to be a whole construction crew in here. And they're going to be working from early in the morning till late at night. And some of those guys just, you know, sit down and pull up a chair and they get their thermos out and they take their lunchbox out or their lunch pail or their, you know, brown bag, whatever they've got, and they eat their lunch. Are we going to tell them, no, you can't do that here? I don't think we would say that. I wouldn't say that under those kinds of circumstances. I think that kind of thing would just become expedient. This one is a little more challenging, I think, but I've actually known of situations where some kind of an emergency happened. I mean, what if, I don't think it would happen right here around this building in this neighborhood, but what if people just urgently and immediately were forced out of their homes? Maybe a tornado rips through and the house next door is just ripped off its foundation. And the older man and woman who live there, they come over here and they say, we need some place to get in out of the rain. And we stand at the door and say, no, you can't come in. You can't come in. Because that's not what this building is for. We don't use the building. Now, I'm not talking about setting up aid stations and those kinds of things, but might there be situations or circumstances where we would just invite somebody to come in and sit down, get out of the cold, get out of the heat, get warm? What if somebody came to the door and said, you know, somebody told me that you've got, you know, like just abundant bathroom facilities. Can I use the restroom? Can I get a drink of water? You know, would we say to somebody like that, no, that water is just for, we only Christians flush here. You can't use that facility. I shouldn't do that. This is a serious question, and I don't mean to brush it aside by being facetious. But I really don't think we do something like that. In other words, we would recognize that expediency might require us from time to time to allow this building to be used for things that we could not go to the New Testament and put our finger on and say, we know absolutely that that's a right thing. Again, someone young or old just taking a bathroom break during the services. Where in the world would you go in the New Testament, or Old Testament for that matter, to establish authority for going to the bathroom? And even if you say, I only do it before or between or after, I don't do it during the worship services, you're still doing it here in the building. But where would you produce specific authority for doing that kind of thing? Well, it falls into the realm of expediency. It expedites our ability to be able to worship, to allow you to be able to use facilities like that from time to time. What about, you know, we have two areas up here. If you're visiting with us, then you may not be familiar with these areas. But I was told even before I came here, and I was almost like you're given a blueprint, and here it is. This area up here, that's where the kids play after church. Okay, fine. You know, in other words, you walk around up here at your own risk. You know, if the kids run you over out there in the aisle, we're gonna fuss at them. You come up here, you take your balance into your own hands. Now this is the spousal waiting area over here. You want to send a message to your wife or your husband, I am ready to go, you come up here. And you stand in this area. And supposedly they see you and they know, she's ready to go. I've got to break this conversation. And, you know, again, if you're visiting with us, you might not have known that. As a matter of fact, I can see by the looks on some of your faces that some of the members didn't know those things. Didn't know those things either. But what about that kind of thing? I mean, you know, we don't want the children to be wild. We don't want them to be loud. We don't want them to be hurting each other or hurting other people. The elders, a few months ago, asked the parents to help us kind of keep a lid on that. And we appreciate the fact that the parents have done that, try to help us keep things under the control. But we still let the kids play. Where in the New Testament, you know, what command, example, or necessary inference? It doesn't have to be even a specific command. Where would you go in the New Testament to justify our allowing the children to play up here? We do. It's in the building. You know, we'd rather have them playing in here than running around in the parking lot. We'd rather have them where we can keep an eye on them, where we can watch them, where we know what they are. But you see what I'm saying? That's just expedient. That expedites, makes it more convenient. More encouraging for parents. I'll bring my kids. I want them to want to go. I want them to be happy that we're going to services, that they're going to get to spend some time with their friends. I want it to be a positive experience for them. And so we allow that kind of thing to happen. Those are just some of the things. There might be others, and these might not be even the best illustrations. But I do think they make the point in regard to expediency that we need to be careful when we say we don't use our building for anything but that we can't have book, chapter, and verse authority for. Well, most of the time we do. And I have no problem with most of these things, really with all of these things under the right circumstances, and perhaps others too. Sometimes, you wouldn't do any of these kinds of things. No provisions, for example. Go back and look at the book of Exodus. Or look at 2 Chronicles and see if you can find any provisions that were made any place, anywhere in the Old Testament for restroom facilities in either the tabernacle or the temple. And you won't find them. And the reason you won't find them is because of the danger of profaning a holy place. That kind of thing would have had the danger of actually profaning the holy place. And so when you went to the temple, when you went to the sanctuary, it would never have entered your mind that we're going to let the kids play, or we're going to eat a sandwich, or we're going to go to the bathroom, we're going to use the restroom facilities, or we're going to feed our children. We don't do those kinds of things here. Why? Because this place is holy. This place is sanctified. That's not true of this. That's not true of this. This isn't the church. I mean, that is absolutely correct. It's just a place that facilitates the command that God gives to local churches, the teaching and the instruction that God gives to local churches to assemble together. God's building and the church building. Those are important questions, I think. You may be thinking, well, what's the point of a lesson like this? Those questions are asked. People in the religious world have been asking for years and continue to ask, where is the authority to have a church building? And again, I think most of the time when people ask that question, what they really mean is, you don't have authority to have a church building. We need to be able to answer them correctly. Yes, we do have authority. We have biblical authority to provide a place for the church to meet. It is inherent in the command to assemble. The command to assemble assumes that a place will be provided. Now, what kind of place? God doesn't say. Does it have to be free? Or can we pay rent? Or can we purchase it? God doesn't say. He just says assemble. It wouldn't be expedient in Kazakhstan or China or many of the places where Brother Buchanan goes. It wouldn't be expedient for brethren to build a facility like this. But it is expedient here in this country. And I'm not going to back away from, I'm not going to be embarrassed. And I'm not going to be pushed into a corner where somebody thinks that, I've got them right where I want them, that they don't have any authority for owning a church building. Absolutely, yes, we do. Yes, we do. And I don't have any more right to tell somebody you must own a building than they have to tell me you can't own a building. God leaves it up to us to make those judgments about things. The building is not the church. I said at the very beginning of the lesson, and you know, if there is confusion in anybody's mind about how the word church is used in the Bible, it's been helpful to me for many years to just always remember, anytime you see the word church, just think people. Just think people. It's always people. If it's the universal church, it's the people who are a part of that body of the saved. God adds people to that body. And He removes them from it. And God doesn't make any mistakes. You're not accidentally a part of the body of saved people. If you're there, it's because that's where you belong. And then there are local churches. But all a local church is just a collection of people. Now, the difference between the universal and the local church is the universal church doesn't require any judgment. God adds people to that body. The local church is total judgment. total judgment. We accept most people into membership in the local church just based on their claim that they are baptized believers. Have you ever thought about that? You know, just based on their, I'm baptized. Okay, you can be a member of this body. Well, we may very well, under circumstances like that, accept members into a local body who aren't members of the body of saved people. That happened in the first century, by the way. It happened in a church where an apostle was a member. The apostle John said they went out from us, 1 John chapter 2, they went out from us, but they were not of us. And what they were was not revealed to us, John said, until they left. In other words, we had people who were members of our local church and we thought they were saved. We thought they were part of us. But we found out they weren't. And we didn't know that till they left. Local church membership involves judgment. But universal church membership doesn't. God will add you to His church. He'll add you to His body of saved people tonight in exactly the same way and on exactly the same basis that He did those 3,000 people in Jerusalem on that first Pentecost after the death, burial, and resurrection of Christ. If you will confess that you believe that Jesus is God's Son. They did that, by the way. When Peter preached that God has made Him both Lord and Christ, this Jesus whom you were crucified, Luke tells us that some of them came to the apostles and said, "Men and brethren, what shall we do?" What they were saying was, "Peter, we believe you. We believe that we just crucified the Son of God, that Jesus was the Son of God." And so they already have believed, and they've already confessed that they believe. In Acts chapter 2 and verse 38, Peter tells them, "Repent. And let every one of you be baptized in the name of Jesus for the remission of sins." And when they did that, 3,000 of them did that. Luke tells us later on in Acts chapter 2 and verse 47 that God added them to that body of saved people. God will add you to the church, not the East Side Church of Christ. He'll add you to the body of saved people tonight if you will respond to the invitation and obey the gospel. Now, if you're already a Christian or if you become a Christian tonight, and if it's expedient, if it's convenient, we'd love to have you be a part of the East Side local body. And we'd be glad to talk with you about that and ask you some questions. And based upon how those questions are answered, welcome you into this local fellowship to worship with us in this collective. Perhaps you're a member of this body or some other body, and there's some sin that's separating you from God. And we always close a service like this, giving everyone the opportunity to make things right with God. So if you're here tonight and you are subject in any way to God's invitation, you either need to be added to the body or maybe restored to the body. If there's anything at all that we can assist you in doing, in being in a right relationship with God tonight, please let us know how we can help you. Come down to one of these front seats right now while we stand and sing this song of encouragement. We invite you to come.